Kia ora and welcome to Emirates Podcast, episode 257. Today is Thursday, June 23rd, 2011. Well, it's winter now, and winter is a new season, and changing seasons means changes. Well, actually it does, but it's sort of coincidental. I'm going to talk about that first today, and then I have updates on the news, which for New Zealand must mean updates on natural disasters, or so it seems, and that's later. But first, it is now winter, officially, but because we've passed the winter solstice, that means the days are getting longer, which for me, a person who hates winter wherever it is, that is a very good thing indeed. Now, of course, this I can't complain too much. This has been a really mild winter. May was the warmest May on record. June is on track to be, if not the warmest May, June rather, one of the warmest Junes on record. And, of course, that's caused some problems. Queenstown, which is our winter playground, has its winter festival starting, and there's no snow in the ski fields. So a lot of the events that would have been held there have had to be canceled. And so that's a bit of a problem. But some of the winteriest weather is actually in July, not June. So with any luck, the ski fields will be able to open at some stage this year. But so far, nothing. But it is winter, and that means rain. And it has been raining a lot, not just today. And that's caused some problems with getting the decks finished, as it would, because it's all outside work. But I can now report that the deck is finished. The construction of the deck is finished. They have to come back and put the fences in, but that's going to be a little while yet. And that's good because that gives me a chance to do some little bits and pieces I need to do before they do their thing. Hopefully anyway, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, for one thing, it's easier to get to some of the gardens to take out the plants that are going now before the fences go up. But we'll see. But that is definitely making progress, and the deck looks wonderful. It still has to be stained, but that's not going to happen until the weather gets better. But the bigger change is actually more personal. A long time ago, I mentioned that I'd gone to the doctor and been given one of these blood test order things for tests for someone my age to go get tested, and I just never get around to it. And then the next time I went to the doctor, which I think was for a gout attack or something, she said, now this time, don't run away. Make sure you get these tests. And I said, I absolutely will. And then I absolutely didn't. So time passed. And a few weeks ago, I got in the mail, unsolicited, an order for blood tests and also an offer for a free heart health checkup or whatever. And I said, right, I'm definitely going to do it this time because I've been meaning to. It's not like I was avoiding it. I just didn't get to it. But when, of course, I didn't get to it. So then I got another one in the mail a few weeks later. And I write, right, definitely going to do this. And I didn't do it. And then I got another one in the mail. And I didn't do that one either. Well, actually, I may have. I can't remember if I got three or four altogether. But the last one, finally, I decided I'm definitely going to do this. I'm definitely going to get this sorted once and for all, particularly because I hadn't been feeling well for a couple of weeks leading up to it. And I thought, right, I've got to get this sorted. And I need to know where I stand rather than just worrying about it all the time as I had been doing. So last week on Wednesday, I think it was, I gathered up my courage, such as it was, fasted overnight, and that was a bigger deal, and headed off to the vampires.
I am Dracula.
No, the kind you pay for, not the kind that fly in the window. They're actually called phlebotomist, which I always thought was the oddest job title there is. When I was younger, and the first time I ever saw it, I thought it was somebody who took phlegm out of people. But anyway. So I did that, and I scheduled an appointment to go to the practice, the doctor's surgery this week, giving them, I thought, an extra day just to make sure that the test got back. And the person I saw was actually the practice nurse, who is a registered nurse who deals with the sorts of stuff that doesn't require a doctor, like this sort of consultation. So I went in, and the results were pretty much what I would have expected, and bad. That's not entirely true. It wasn't all bad. My PSA was negative, which is always a good thing. And my liver function was good. My kidney function was good. Now, it did surprise me a bit about my kidneys because I would have thought as a person with gout that I might have some issues there. But no, it's fine. However, the cholesterol side of things was a disaster. My good cholesterol was bad. My bad cholesterol was even worse. And it just is not a pretty picture. Apparently, I'm veering towards high risk for heart attack and or stroke if these shadows remain unchanged. And it's bad enough that I've been given 3 months to turn things around. And if I don't succeed, or at least making significant progress, I suppose, they're going to put me on medication to control it. Now, this, of course, has been the thing I've been dreading the most all along, because I know so many people who are my age or even younger who are on some sort of prescription for something or other, high blood pressure or cholesterol or whatever. And I did not want to be on a prescription. I wanted to remain prescription-free, you know, chronic prescription or whatever. And so this is my last chance probably to avoid that fate or worse. And it amounts basically to some lifestyle changes. I'm to get more exercise, vigorous exercise, and to watch what I eat, obviously eat less, lose weight, and also drastically watch my fat intake. And she actually told me to do some of my own research online, which time was doctors didn't want you to go looking around online because you'd find things and that was wrong or what have you, and would cause more problems than it would help. But this day and age, I think they realize that people are going to do it anyway, so they might as well give them, I don't know, some guidance or something as they do it. So some of the things I found include that people who are at risk of cardiovascular disease, which is what I am at the moment, should have far less fats as part of their diet than someone who is normal and healthy. And which isn't, I mean, that's not a big issue of and by itself, because my goal is to get as little as possible over the next 3 months so that I can bring those levels down. Once they're down back into the normal range, then we can find out what works and what doesn't. But she said that I should start walking, and as a starter, because I haven't been doing anything, see what I can tolerate for one thing. But she said I should. She was ticking off some of the things I could do. She said, well, you could join a gym, and I'm thinking to myself, that's not going to happen. She's saying you could take up running and think, that's not going to happen. Or you could do a sport you like, that's not going to happen either. So that leaves walking, which, as I've said before, has always been an issue for me because of how mountainous it is where we live. It's not really mountainous. It's just very hilly. And we also have this cross trainer, which I mentioned to her. It's, what's the other word for it? Elliptical. But she said that's an excellent thing to use for an excellent workout, but I wouldn't start with that, she said. And I was thinking, no, I don't think that would be a very good idea either. Going from a cold start to a full gallop is not a good idea for someone like me who's got health risks and stuff. But as it happens, Nigel and I had already started making changes. She said, the nurse said that I shouldn't cook with any oil whatsoever. She said it would be better for me to eat, if the food was to stick to the pan and burn, that would be better for me than having any oil. And as it happens, we recently changed our pots and pans to this stuff by Tefal with a little red dot in the middle. And I don't mean to do a commercial endorsement or anything, but they are really the most remarkable pots and pans I've ever owned. Nothing sticks to them. So we don't actually need any oil except for flavor, really. And even then, you don't really need that. So that's not so much of a problem. And we have other ways of cooking things so that we don't need to fry things or what have you. We can grill them or whatever, but ways that are fat-free cooking. So that's all really good and very positive. And so she said that, and she gave me a little cheat sheet to take to the grocery store to read labels, although there's basically only, well, not only, but there's two main things I have to remember, and that's that anything that I buy has to have a total fat of less than 10 grams per 100 grams and has to have less than 10 grams per 100 grams of sugars as well. But that's just for now, and obviously I want to get below that. But I was looking at she actually suggested this. I was looking at the labels of things we already have in the cupboard, and it turns out that virtually everything is way below all those levels already anyway, because I generally have been buying pretty well over the years. This is nothing new. I've been trying to be careful about the amount of sugar and sodium and fat that's in the things that I buy, prepared stuff, and we're talking here, obviously. And so I began to puzzle about this, about why my cholesterol has gone up. I mean, obviously all of this has happened partly because I'm overweight. That's the sort of thing that does happen when you get overweight and get older as well. But she said by 75, everybody has problems with this sort of stuff. And I thought, yeah, but that's almost 25 years away. And so I thought, what has caused this to suddenly happen? Now, there is one possibility. I could be genetically predisposed to having cholesterol issues to becoming diabetic, even blood pressure. Some people are do have genetic issues with those. Or it could be that something else is going on. Now, the fact that my blood pressure is a little bit high and the fact that my blood sugar is a little bit high, I think is related to being overweight. And I am reasonably confident that if I bring my weight down, that those problems will resolve themselves. They generally do for most people. Now, I may have genetic predisposition to develop diabetes, especially if I'm not careful, because my father was diabetic and my mother's uncle was diabetic. But like I said, I'm still optimistic that those will take care of themselves. So that brings back to the cholesterol problem. Like, where did this come from? How did this happen? Don't eat a lot of red meat or any other animal fat of that, animal meat of that sort. Generally, it's just eggs, which can be a problem if you have too many. And chicken, and chicken is not particularly high in cholesterol, especially white meat. So I'm thinking, where is this coming from? Then I remembered something that she said in passing. She was advising on diet and stuff, and she said, be especially careful of dairy products because dairy products are very high in fat. Milk and cheese and yogurt, even the low-fat ones, are still very high in fat, so try to avoid those. And then it hit me. Over the past year or maybe even up to two or thereabouts, I don't remember exactly, I started eating a lot more cheese, and I mean a lot more cheese. One of my favorite snacks was just to cut off some cheese and eat it. And cheese, of course, is extremely high in bad fats. And I'm thinking that in terms of dietary sources, I mean, obviously I've got lifestyle issues as well, but in terms of the dietary source, or if you will, of where a lot of these problems come from, I think that's it. The fact that I suddenly, not suddenly, but the fact that I pretty dramatically increased my intake of cheese is probably one of the main problems. So I've stopped that. I've had no cheese whatsoever since since then. And starting little baby steps toward exercise because I don't have the stamina to do a long walk or anything like that. I'll get there eventually, but I need to work up to that sort of thing because I also don't want to put a shock to my system or anything either. But as I said, we have already started making changes, and I'm reading the labels diligently to make sure that I don't accidentally get something I shouldn't have. And I've also been studying up on the things that you can eat that actually lower cholesterol or raise the good cholesterol, as the case may be. And, you know, things like oatmeal and oat bran and almonds and walnuts and other nuts, things like that. And so I'm going to be incorporating those changes as well, make sure that the fats that I do get, because everybody needs to have fat in their diet, comes from those good sources and not from the bad sources. So I decided, this is all because, I'm mentioning all of this because I decided a long time ago, after listening to other people's podcasts, that if I did ever develop, I'll wait till Sunny's done. I decided a long time ago that if I did ever develop any sort of health issue, that I would talk about it honestly and openly on the podcast because it could help somebody else. You never know who might be listening and who might hear something you say and think, that's me too. And so that's the thing. Now, hopefully I'll never have to discuss anything seriously wrong. But on the other hand, the sorts of things I'm talking about here are the kinds of things that a lot of people face at one stage or another. So maybe my journey will be useful to other people. So anyway, that's my big news, if you will, my new change. And we'll see how we're going. Now, I should say, I talked about making lifestyle changes and that I've already started that. And I have. I've already lost a couple of kilos over the past couple of weeks. So, you know, things are starting to, things are starting to move, but that sounds all wrong. I'm starting to make improvements is what I'm trying to say. And I expect that over the next several months, things will get better. And I'm optimistic that when I get to the end of this 3-month journey, that I'll be where I need to be to avoid any further issues. Hopefully, anyway. Now, moving on to the other topic. There has been an unrelenting, I'm laughing not out of humor, but out of exasperation, an unrelenting parade of natural disaster-related issues facing New Zealand. The most recent has been the Chilean earthquake because the ash cloud has spread over the southern hemisphere all the way to us. It's back to Chile now. And that has disrupted air travel all over the region. There have been times, Air New Zealand usually flies, but there have been times when even it couldn't, when the ash cloud was too low. Qantas and its subsidiary Jetstar generally haven't been flying, and that's led to speculation that they've been looking at saving money rather than being really concerned about passenger safety, because the jet cloud has been very high up at the range where jets usually fly, around 35,000 feet or thereabouts, 30 to 35,000, somewhere in there. They can actually fly much lower than that, but it requires more fuel because the atmosphere is thicker and there's more drag on the aircraft, which therefore burns more fuel and is more expensive. Air New Zealand has gone ahead and flown at the lower altitude, and they've burned more fuel, which cost them more. The ticket's already sold, so they can't like suddenly charge these people more. So it's affected their profits. Whereas Qantas and its subsidiary Jetstar didn't fly, and yesterday they issued a statement saying, contrary to belief, it's not out of money. It actually has cost them more to leave the planes on the ground. And I'd actually like to see some evidence to back that up, because I'm not sure that that's actually true. But be that as it may, that has been a major disruption in this part of the world. There are people who are stranded on either side of the Tasman and just waiting for the opportunity to fly home. But the people who flew Qantas and Jetstar are more likely to get stranded on one side or the other than people who flew Air New Zealand, or I presume one of the codeshare ones as well. I don't know. But so that's the least destructive of the natural disaster situations facing New Zealand right now. The bigger one, of course, is the ongoing thing with Christchurch. There have been a series of aftershocks and shakes and so on. Some big ones that happened just last week, and even just the other day, there was a swarm of more that were, I think the strongest was like 5.4 or something like that. And it's just like every couple of hours, there was another earthquake, this 3.2 and 3.4, and I think there was a 4.8 mixed in there somewhere. So it's not that they're huge, heavy shocks. It's just that they keep going on and on and on. And it's beginning to be quite tiresome, as you might imagine, for the people who are affected by that. Well, the shock of last week was particularly bad, and it caused liquefaction again all over this area in the eastern suburbs of Christchurch, and I'll talk about liquefaction a bit more in a minute. But the area has been particularly hard hit because of this liquefaction that's been ongoing, and so the government was under pressure to decide what are they going to do? Are they going to keep these areas? Are they going to abandon them? Or what are they going to do? And today they finally announced that they've divided Christchurch up into four zones: a red zone, an orange zone, a green zone, and a white zone. Now, the red zone is area where it's so bad, the land itself is so badly damaged that it will be years or even decades before they can ever build on it again. The orange zone is area that is probably got a lot of damaged houses within it, but the red zone has about 5,000 houses. The orange zone has houses in it that may or may not be, the land actually, may or may not be that badly damaged. They don't know yet because it's not fully assessed. And that's got about 10,000 houses in it. Many of them ultimately the land will be unbuildable. Others can be restored. The green zone are areas that the repairs can be made. They can basically get on with it. And the white zone is an area that hasn't been evaluated at all, or at least not since the major aftershocks of last week. And I don't know how many houses are in all those other zones, in the green zone and the white zone. But what the government has announced they're going to do is they are going to make an offer to all of the homes, all the 5,000 homes in the red zone, that they will give them the full value, what they call the rateable value, at the time of the quake, which was based on 2007 figures, which means a little bit out of date. Now, they feel, the government says, that it's a fair offer because they've looked at the change in property value throughout New Zealand, and not a lot has changed over the years. In some cases, the values have actually gone down, so they might be a little overly generous. And so people can take that, less any money that the insurance companies have paid them for their damage, and they're done. They can leave. And buy somewhere else or rebuild somewhere, so whatever it is they want to do. Or the second option is they can have the government buy their land and then settle with the insurance company over the house. Now let's go back to the first one first. There may be some properties that are worth more than they were in 2007. Maybe they did a huge addition or something. And in those cases, the government says that they're going to try to negotiate with the people to come up with a solution. But the other people, you would think, well, why wouldn't you just sell the whole thing? Why would you just sell the land to the government and not the house as well? Why not settle with them? And that's because some people might have really good insurance. They might have full replacement value for the house rather than just, you know, the most recent value, which was, as I said, 2007. So they would get more money by doing that than they would by settling with the government. And the government wanted to give them that flexibility, or so they say. And so those are the two options that are on the table. People have 9 months to decide what they're going to do. It gives them time to talk to their bank, because presumably they're mortgaged, and to their lawyers or what have you, to sort out a scheme. Now, apparently it's going to be 2 months before the application forms are even available. And so it's not like they have to rush into any decisions right away. But the early indications, and very early indications, because the announcement was only made, as I'm recording, about an hour and a half ago, are that many people are very happy with that because they just went out. This is related, but I'll make the connection in a minute. Last month was the highest recorded departure rate of New Zealanders going to Australia for permanent or long-term resettlement, recorded in 32 years. And one of the main drivers of that has been people leaving Christchurch. So what this is all about is it's trying to give people a way and reason to stay in Christchurch rather than abandon it. Apparently there are up to something like 17,000 sections, which is a lot, I guess, in Christchurch that either are or soon will be available to build on. They're either already cleared and ready to go with the, you know, the services in, or they're in the process of getting all the permits and stuff for that to happen. So it's not like there's no land to build on. And there's, of course, also existing houses that are available for sale. So just because these 5,000 houses are going to be demolished doesn't mean that they're going to lose all the people who live in those 5,000 houses, or the 10,000 that are up in the air at the moment, so to speak. It's entirely possible that all of those people could be resettled somewhere else in Christchurch. However, I would expect that Christchurch will lose population before this is all over, particularly because the aftershocks just keep going on and on and on, and people are getting really sick of it. I know that if I lived there, I think I would just want to go. I would not want to stay there anymore. And I can certainly understand why people would feel that way. But we'll ultimately see what happens. I honestly don't know what they're going to end up doing, the majority of these people. But at least today they got one step closer to getting the certainty they need to get on with their lives. And that's a very good thing indeed. But one of the things I mentioned briefly was about liquefaction, because that is something that keeps coming up again and again when we're talking about the Christchurch earthquake, because it is one of the things that causes the most damage in earthquakes like this. And it actually relates to something that Roger Green posted to my last podcast, Amarin's 256. He said, "Next podcast, please explain liquefaction after an earthquake. Oh, and why are all those drivers motoring through such deep water? Do they want to stall out?" First of all, Roger's referring to a video I posted to my blog last week after the after that big aftershock, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this episode. But it depicts, among other things, liquefaction, and also people going very fast down city streets, and one lady gets stuck in a hole with the front end of her car down in the water. And I'm answer that part first. I think that the reason why people were driving so fast is because they're locals and they know the streets, and so they feel that there isn't any risk. Now, whether or not that's sensible or not is a whole other issue, but I suspect that's why they were driving so fast, because they're local and they know the streets. However, as that lady in the video found out, you can't always see big holes in the road because the water's over them, and that sort of thing can happen. They really shouldn't be driving fast. But I think another factor that enters into it is that people are so sick of these aftershocks and the aftermath of the aftershocks that they're just maybe not caring what so much, you know. They're just kind of going for it, and whatever happens, happens kind of thing. I think a little bit of both is probably play. Maybe other things I don't know. But I suspect that it's probably mostly because they're locals and they know the streets. But to talk a little bit more about the Liquefaction itself, I'm going to do something I haven't done before. And that is I'm going to play a clip from another podcast. No, actually, I have played clips from other podcasts, but not this one. This is from Too Political, my other podcast that I do with my friend Jason. Now, some of you listen to it, I know, but the others may not have ever heard it. And but this is actually kind of typical of what we do. We just have a little chat about something else. It's not all about politics, despite the name. Sometimes it's news or current events or something like the Christchurch earthquake, which is a bit of both. Because he asked me about Liquefaction, and we recorded this last week. And because it's relevant and pretty much discusses what I wanted to say about it, I thought I would play that now so that you can hear about the Liquefaction. And also, for those of you who've never heard the show, get an idea of what that podcast is like. So it's like killing two birds with one stone. So here is that discussion from Too Political, and then I'll be back after that with more.
I have a quick question. You had another earthquake in Christchurch.
Yes.
And you posted this raw video from a New Zealand television station?
No, I think it was actually a New Zealand Herald reporter.
Oh, the New Zealand Herald reporter, okay. And there was all this water.
Yep.
What is that?
Well, it's funny you should ask that because Roger Green posted a question over on my Amarin's podcast blog, and I'm going to actually be talking about this in more detail in the next episode. That is called soil liquefaction. Some people call the gunk that comes out liquefaction, but that's incorrect. The process is liquefaction, and it puts up water. What happens, the gist of it is that when there's a severe shaking, as in an earthquake, the bonds in the soil that keep the water in its place are ruptured, essentially, and the water is forced to the surface, sometimes from many meters below ground. Okay. And so you see this water gushing out, in some cases almost in a volcano-like thing, and very similar to it. And when it's gone, there'll be a crater in the ground where this was.
A sinkhole, okay.
Yeah, and it can cause quicksand.
All of a sudden, because they mentioned that, and I was going to Google it, but I didn't have time to do it. Whenever I saw it, I don't remember, maybe it might have been this morning, I think, like, what is that? What's also very interesting is that if you watch the video and they're sort of filming somebody's driveway,
yeah,
that before the shaking, there wasn't a crack in the driveway. After the shaking, there is.
Yeah.
Like, wow, look at that. Oh, okay. Several people mentioned, oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, like, there's too much water. I thought, well, you know, a water main broke or something like that. But it was too much water. And this woman talked about getting her, yeah, it's the second time I've gotten my car caught, but at least I can get it out and get home. So I had no idea. I'd never realized that that's what happened. So it was quite interesting.
Yeah, and it doesn't happen everywhere. There have to be the right conditions for it, the right soil types. It has to be a reasonably poorly drained soil that it has the water retained in it. Most of the damage that happened back in that San Francisco earthquake, when was it, the 80s or 90s? I've forgotten now when that was. Long time ago, anyway.
The one in October, the one that where they were playing the World Series, yeah.
Yeah. Most of the damage was caused by liquefaction, especially in the Mission District. And the areas that were on firmer ground, if you like, suffered little or no damage. But the Mission District in particular was really quite hard hit, and the problem there was liquefaction. Because essentially what happens for a building when liquefaction hits is that everything that's underneath it is suddenly gone, and all of the support for the building disappears, and so the thing collapses. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out
it's sort of like you dehydrated. It's sort of like what's that when they did ice cream? You know, the astronauts. What's that process? I'm getting too old. freeze dry it. That's kind of, it's not exact, but that's what it is. You're taking all the moisture out.
Well, it's more like you're releasing it. The best analogy I can come up with is if you put a book on a desk, you know, it stays there. It's not going to go anywhere. But if the desk were to suddenly turn into muck, the book would fall through.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what happens in liquefaction. The support that's underneath the building, whatever it is suddenly not there anymore, and it can't hold up. Now, there are a whole, I'll talk about this in more on my own podcast, but the gist of it is that is the main cause of damage, aside from the shear force that happens when a rigid structure is, you know, shaken back and forth.
Shaken and it crumbles, yeah.
Yeah, there's the back and forth motion is what causes buildings to collapse, not the up and down one so much, although it can. But the greatest damage that happens from the shaking itself is the shear force that happens when a building goes back and forth. And the other thing that causes the greatest number of collapses is liquefaction.
Wow.
The other kind of shaking, not so much. But what's a real worry about that area is that most of Christchurch is built in kind of a bowl. And so it's really susceptible to liquefaction. And most of these earthquakes that are happening on faults they didn't know existed. In fact, so far, all of them have been on faults they didn't know existed a year or two ago.
Which in your country is really hard to believe, but anyway.
Well, I suppose because it was stable for so long.
Yeah.
You know, it never really occurred to them. I mean, all of New Zealand is susceptible to earthquake of one sort or another. There's pretty much, I don't think there's anywhere that isn't. I mean, Australia is too, and they didn't know that until in relative recent times as well.
Well, it's the Midwest, the New Madrid Fault. They had that gigantic earthquake in the early 1800s or 18-teens, and it moved the Mississippi.
Yeah. Well, it is said to have rung church bells in Boston. Yeah, it was, and it also caused cracks in Maine, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
It was the most powerful earthquake in the lower 48 in recorded history. And that fault line runs directly beneath the sports stadium in Memphis. And one day, it's going to rupture again.
Yeah.
Don't know where, obviously, but it's inevitable.
Okay, on another really cheery note here.
Well, the good news is it may never happen in our lifetimes.
Well, that's true. The two horsemen of the apocalypse here. Okay.
So that's basically the story of liquefaction, what happens, why it's a problem, and it's that the ground underneath, well, there's two problems. The damage it causes in the first place, all the muck going everywhere, which has to be cleaned up and removed and cleaned up. But the other problem is that the ground can then become unstable for building on, and that's the problem in that red zone in Christchurch and why they are going to demolish 5,000 homes, all because of the usability of the ground has been compromised. And there are ways to make land buildable. There are a lot of techniques that are used, including vibration, where they basically vibrate the land to drive the water out, those sorts of things. But it takes a long time for an area that size to be, as the government likes to put it, remediated. And so that's why they're doing all this. And they do say it will take years, probably decades, before that land will be rebuilt, if it ever is. Who knows? So that's some updates on what's going on in and around Christchurch at the moment. It's been a very, very newsy week, really. And as I said, I will put a link to the original video that a lot of this is commenting on in the show notes for this episode. Now I do have a phone message.
Hi, Arthur. Happy Gay Pride Month. I'd send you flowers, but it's too expensive. This is Roger. Bye.
Well, thanks, Roger. It is Gay Pride Month, but you didn't need to send flowers because by making that call, you've extended my phone line for another 30 days. It's even better. Of course, Gay Pride Month is no big thing here in New Zealand. It's mostly a Northern Hemisphere thing. There are some exceptions in some places in the Southern Hemisphere. But it's never been particularly big here in Auckland or New Zealand generally for some reason. Although I saw on gaynz.com that a Pride Festival Committee is being established to run a permanent GLBT Pride, festival. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't think they know that yet. But the idea is that there will be a permanent body to coordinate this sort of thing. At the moment, the only thing that goes on in Auckland is there's this thing called the Big Gay Out, which is held every February. And it's called that in reference to a concert that's held in New Zealand and Australia called the Big Day Out, where it's an all-day concert thing. And so I think that is where the name comes from. But that's really about it. That's the only real thing that goes on every year, the only big thing. And so I'm gathering that this is meant to be something more. There had been talk about restoring the Hero Parade, which was held. It's a nighttime parade that was held here in New Zealand, I think the week before Sydney's Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras parade. But that ended years ago. It went broke and faced a lot of hostility from the then Auckland City Council and the Conservatives on it. But I don't know if that's ever going to return. But it there may ultimately be something at some point in the year, which would be nice. It'd be nice to have, you know, some sort of festival, cultural festival and stuff. I don't know if they would time it around the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival or not. I don't know. Anyway, that's all in the works. But I decided this year, for no apparent reason, to mark Gay Pride Month by posting on my blog what I call a gay a day, which is basically that every single day this month, I have tried to post at least one blog post that has something to do with gay people. It might be about politics or news, something in the news. It could be about culture, any number of different things. And I have done that, except for one day. One day this month, I couldn't post anything at all. And so that's the only day I missed. We had internet issues that day, and so I couldn't post. But apart from that, I've posted at least one thing every single day. And I don't think I'll do it again. If I do anything like this next year, I'd probably do it just for 1 week. And it's just because I don't like to have this requirement hanging over my head or whatever. And it does give me some sympathy, though, for people who have to work on news websites because they've got to go out and look for content for their news websites every single day and all day long, 24/7. And I don't think I'd want to do that. But, yeah, oh well, it is amazing. It does mean that June is on track to be my most blogged month so far this year. And that's a good thing because I had some months earlier this year where I was just so busy I didn't have time even to blog. And so this month will help kind of even things out because, as you probably remember, my goal every year is to blog once per day, and as an average, not literally once per day, but an average of once per day and or more. And this should help put me back on track to meeting that goal for the year. But that is it for today. That is it for this week. I tried three times to get to do this episode and didn't get through it for one reason or another. So I'm glad I finally made it to the end of this one. But it does mean that since today's Thursday, there's just not enough time left in the week to do another one. But hey, better than nothing, eh? That's what I think anyway. That's it for today. That's it for this week. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com. Or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.